We're going to take a look at the parasha of Milchemes Midyan, and I have here a Chumash Bamidbar in front of me. The parasha begins in Perek Lamed Aleph. In that sense, it's very clean and cut. Vaydaber Hashem el Moshe leimor, nikom nikmas bnei Yisrael me'eis ha-midyanim achar te'osef el amecha. Moshe Rabbeinu gets a separate tzivui, a command, to decimate Midyan, and in a very atypical way, we get an explanation as to why this is so. And that is for the purpose of Nekama. There are a number of points in this parasha that I'd like to address today, a number of questions, the not least of which is that Moshe Rabbeinu understood that this war against Midyan would signal the end of his life, and therefore the question arises as to why, according to Chazal at least, he was very urgent about implementing this mitzvah. You know, in a certain sense, he had a passport for life. He could have delayed it. But one of the questions I want to ask you today in the more hashkafic part of our discussion is the amount of soldiers that were sent out to battle. The psukim indicate that there were 12,000 soldiers, elef lamata, elef lamata. But then in addition, there was another set of elef lamata, and those were in charge of what we call today in modern Hebrew the oref. They're in charge of the community, of protecting the community and staying in the machna. And then in addition to that, Chazal indicated that there was a third set of 12,000. All told, three sets of 12,000. The third set was in charge of tefillah, of praying. An enormous number of chayalim. We're not talking about older people. We're talking about people of draft age, younger than 60, and yet they were left behind for tefillah. That's an interesting point, and we want to come back to that later, God willing, in the hashkafa part of that discussion. As far as the halach is concerned, the Torah commands us to take the biza, and the Torah also commands to give of this biza to the Kohanim and the Levim. And we're going to see that in Pasuk Chav Gimel. Excuse me, in Pasuk Chav Ches, and the Torah says, Varimosem Meches Lashem Me'es Anshem L'chama Yotzim L'atzava Echad L'nefesh Me'chamesh Me'os, and that's going to be divvied up amongst the Kohanim and Levim. In Pasuk Lamed, V'nasato Samla Levim, etc., etc. And this is very interesting, because what we find, and I want to discuss this in just a minute, is that with regard to Biza, the general rule was that as Moshe Rabbeinu conquered Eretz Yisrael, the Biza was divided amongst the Shvatim with the exception of Shevet Levi. The Levim, the Kohanim, did not participate in the Biza. And yet here, in the case of Midyan, which makes Midyan a very unique case, just the opposite is true. There's a command to give of the biza, divvy it up amongst the Kohanim and the Levim. The question is why? What makes this milchama different than the other milchamos that Bnei Yisrael fought in the campaign to destroy and conquer Eretz Yisrael? The next question I want to raise focuses on two psukim that form almost a unit unto itself. And that's Psukim Chav Beis and Chav Gimel. And this is a reference to the clay Midyan, the utensils that were taken as booty from the Midyanites who were decimated. Ach, es hazav, es hakesef. The Torah enumerates here six types of metals. Called Dovra Shayavo Ba'esh, Taviru Ba'esh. Anything that's used in the context of fire has to be placed into the fire. Kol Shaloyavo Ba'esh, Taviru Ba'esh. These are the laws of Heksher Kalim, otherwise known as Giulei Nachrim. You're talking about old, used utensils that came in contact either with fire or with water in a bishul situation by goyim with non-kosher food. And these laws, which are formulated in two places, number one in Aruch Chaim, Tof Ayin Aleph, Tof Nun Aleph, in the laws of Hekshe Kelim for Pesach, and in Yerideya, with regard to Basav Chalav and Blias Isa Veheta, these are the laws of Hekshe Kelim that we're familiar with. The general concept is called Giulei Akum, which means the non-Jews use these Kelim in the context of non-kosher food, and now we, wanting to use these utensils, have to subject them to a process of hechsher. But there are right in the middle of this verse, there are five words that stick out almost as a separate section. Vitaher. And these kelim must be subject to a process of tahara, of purification. Ach b'meini da yischata. And they have to be placed into the same water, says the Gemara at the end of Avodah Zarah, as a nida is tovelas bahem, meaning mikvah for tahara purposes. And basically there are two different concepts here. One is called hechsher kelim, and that's to remove the blias isur. The other is called tvilas kelim, and that's simply to purify the kli. And it's absolutely irrelevant if the kli is brand new, just came out of the manufacturing, or whether it's been used, whether it has a blia, doesn't have a blia. If it was owned by a non-Jew, and now it comes into the possession of a Jew, it has to be subject to tahara v'tayer, achbe mei nida yischata, in a mikvah for a nida, that means 40 saw and all the din. One of the interesting things I found in this parsha is an essay by Rav Matisyo Bloom in a book which is a five-volume set that's called Torah Ladas. I don't know if you're familiar with it. But for Parshas Matos, he has a very interesting discussion with regard to mikveh, regarding the status of sheleg, of snow. Does snow have the same status as water with regard to mikveh? Okay, we'll come back to that a little bit later. On a hashkafic level, I'd love to discuss with you the concept of mikvah, and especially as it pertains to kelim, to utensils, to pots and dishes. Why, if we can, on a philosophical level, can we understand or give some sort of explanation as to why they require tefillah in a mikvah? Again, we're talking about new kelim that have no blias isur, that were never used in the context of non-kosher food. We're going to start our halachic discussion by analyzing the special halachic nature of Milchemes Midjan. The Ramban raises the following question, and that is, why is it that only with regard to Milchemes Midjan, for the first time, do we find Giulei Nachrim and the entire parsha of subjecting the Kelim to Hechsher, whether it's Hagolah, whether it's Libun, to get out the Blia? As a matter of fact, Moshe Rabbeinu was the military leader who fought the campaign against Og and Sichon. And this had taken place earlier. We don't find the parsha of Giulei Akum, of Hechsher Kelim, with regard to Sichon V'Og. Why did the Torah wait, asks the Ramban, in his Perush al Torah, for Milchemes Midjan, in order to command us in the mitzvah of Giulei Akum, of Hechsher Kelim, of Hagolah, Limun, and all the dinim? The Ramban comes up with a fascinating answer. He states that with regard to Milchemes Og and Sichon, where we took the booty, there was no need for Hechsher Kelim. Why not? Says the Ramban, because there's a halacha which is derived by the Gemara in Chulin on Daf Yud Zayin from a pasuk at the beginning of Sefer Dvarim. There it says, Ubatim Malayim Koltuv Asher Lo Milesa. And the Gemara derives from that pasuk I'll quote to you the language of the Gemara. Kadle de chazire ishtaru lahu. Even something as non-kosher as chazir, as pig meat, was mutar for Bnei Yisrael. There was an absolute hecker, says the Ramban, based on the Gemara in Chulin, to eat non-kosher food at that time. However, says the Ramban, that only applies to Mulchemes Kibush Eretz Yisrael. As long as we're involved in conquering Eretz Yisrael, the land that has to be divvied up, whether it's on this side of the Yarden or this side of the Yarden, even Eivor HaYarden, in the case of Og V'Sichon, the lands that were divided up in this week's parasha amongst Bnei Gad Bnei Reuven, Chatzi Shev and Menashe, those lands are subject to this heter, which is called Batim Meleim Koltuv. However, when it comes to Mulchemes Midjan, the nature of this war and this mitzvah of conquering and vanquishing Midjan is totally different. We're no longer discussing taking Eretz Yisrael. The land of Midjan doesn't belong to the Jewish people, and it will not be divvied up with the rest of Eretz Canaan. And therefore the heter of Batim Meleim Kol Tuv, which allows us even to eat from non-kosher food, does not apply within the context of Milchemes Midjan. And therefore here in Midjan, for the first time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to command us to take all the Giulei Nachrim, all that Bliya, all the Issa that had penetrated into the walls of the Kli, and get rid of them, and remove them through Hechsher Kalim. He says, the Midjan lo haya mishalehem, the land of Midjan doesn't belong to the Jewish people. Lo lachus artsam. The whole purpose of the mitzvah to destroy Midjan is linkom nikmasam. It's only for the sake of nikama. To destroy Midjan, the lachu, and to take shlalam, but not ben isur v'kleyem. In the kalim there was an isur. I have a question to ask you. And that is based on the Rambam. Until now we saw the Ramban. The Rambam, in the 8th parak of Hilchas Melachim, writes the following. He says, Chalutzei tzava, kshikansu v'gvul ha'akum, v'ikavshum, mutalem lechol nevelus u'trefes basa chazir v'chayotzevahem. The Rambam doesn't make any qualification whatsoever. He says that insofar as we are fulfilling the mitzvah of milchama, and there are no qualifications that the Rambam imposes here, mutal em lechol nevelus u'trefes. Basically, therefore, according to the Rambam Shita, we don't understand why was it necessary to get rid of Giulei Nachrim in the case of Midjan, since any milchama is subject to this halacha of a heter. And the Radbaz raises this question, one of the super commentaries on the Rambam, and he answers that with regard to milchama, the Torah gives a very limited heter for non-kosher food. It only applies when it's absolutely necessary. For example, if the soldiers are famished, they don't have access to food, then and only then are they allowed to partake of non-kosher food. He says they don't require to be in a situation of sakana, of absolute danger, in which their lives are on the line, because that would be the regular halacha of v'chai b'hem of pikuach nefesh. But nevertheless, it applies, according to the Rambam, whenever they are suffering from ra'av, from hunger. Now, therefore, says the Radbaz, if I understand him correctly, the bliya of Giulei Akum, let's say, for example, we vanquish Midjan, we take their utensils, the nevela and trefa that is absorbed in the utensil itself is asur to us. Again, we're only going to allow, according to the Rambam Shita, in a case that's of very serious necessity, to eat nevelos and trefas. but the object per se still remains awesome. Okay, if anybody wants to mute their microphones, it might be helpful. We could hear a little better. But if you have a camera, leave it on. Okay, great. In any event, the real problem with the Rambam is the Ramban's kasha, because the Ramban asked, why didn't we get the parsha of Giulei Nachrim with regard to Melchemes Og V'Sichom? Could it be, therefore, that the Rambam holds that with regard to Kibush Eretz Yisrael, that Milchama engenders an absolute heter, what we call Hutra, as far as the Velus and Trefus is concerned? Now, I don't know the answer to that question, but it really requires a lot of research. I want to learn with you another Ramban about the war against Midjan. The Ramban points out that with regard to Milchemes Eretz Yisrael, the Kohanim and Levium have no ability to enjoy any benefit of the biza, of the shalal that's taken. Here in Milchemes Midjan, for the first time, the command is given to divvy up some of the shalal, at least 2%, to the Kohanim and the Levium. They get a chelek. Why? Because Milchemes Midjan is a Milchemes Nekama. It's not a Milchemes Kibush Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, the law is that with regard to other Milchamos, other than Kibush, we give a portion to the Kohanim and the Levim. Now, in order to understand this a little bit better, I want to read to you the Rambam at the very end of Hilcha Shmita of Yovel. That's Perek Yud Gimel Halacha Tes. The Rambam writes, Halacha Yud, excuse me, the Rambam writes, Kol Shevet Levi Musharim Shelo Yinchalu B'Eretz Knan. I don't know if you knew this. Shevet Levi is not permitted to take a portion of Eretz Knan. They designated 42 Arei Levium for the Levium to live in, but beyond that, they did not get a chelek in Eretz Canaan. And not only that, they're not allowed to take a chelek of Eretz Canaan. V'chein, and furthermore, says the Rambam, hey muzharim shelo yitlu chelek bebiza, b'shah shekov shemes ha'arim. When the cities of Canaan are vanquished by Bnei Yisrael, they're not allowed to give, or let's put it this way, the Levium are not allowed to take any chelek in the biza. That's all part of Eretz Yisrael. And the Rambam says, Shenemar, and he quotes Psukim, both in Sefer Dvarim and in Sefer Bamidbar, Lo Yiel HaKohanim V'Levim, Kol Shevet Levi Chelek V'Nachlam Yisrael. What does that mean, says the Rambam? Chelek V'Biza, V'Nachla Ba'aretz. In other words, the Torah uses two words here, they're not superfluous. Chelek V'Nachla, Chelek V'Biza, V'Nachla, he means in the Karka of Eretz Yisrael. The Rambam says, Ben Levi al Kohen should not al chelik bebiza. If the Ben Levi grabs part of the biza, in the case of Yerushas Eretz Yisrael, loke, he gets malchus for that. If not al nachla ba'aretz, however, if he takes part of the land of Israel, again violating the law of the Torah, mavir no somimena, we take it away from him. But we don't give him malchus. If you take a look in the Derech Amuna of Reb Chaim Kanevsky, he says, why do you get Malkus in the case of Biza and not in the case of Nachla? He says, usually there's no Malkus for what's called a Lav HaNitan Lihishavam. If you can return that which you took and rectify it, you don't get Malkus. Like, for example, there's no Malkus for Gzela because you can return, and you have to return, the Gazan has to return the object that he stole. That's called the Lav Hanitan LaShava. Same thing, he says, applies in the case of Nachla of Eretz Yisrael. They have to give back that portion that they took from whichever Shevet it was designated for, and therefore there's no Malkus. Why then does the Rambam say that if they take from the Biza, they do get Malkus? The answer is, and this is based on a sugya in Baba Basra, Gezel derabim lo nitan lihishav. In other words, the biza belongs to all of Klal Yisrael. It's a joint ownership. It doesn't belong to any specific member of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, if you misappropriate, if you abscond with that biza, you have no one to return it to. It belongs to the entire tzibur. And therefore, it's not considered a lav hanitan lihishavon. The logic is that the same should apply in Nachla. And you could suggest what I suggested before, that in the case of Nachla, each Shevet and each Mishpach and each Shevet got its own Nachla, so therefore it's Nitan Lishavon. Or perhaps the answer might be that Karka ain't an Exelts. Okay, that's a more complicated sugya, not for us today. Finally, in Aluch Yud Aleph, the Rambam says all that we've discussed applies to Kibush Eretz Yisrael. And there we cannot give anything to the Levium and to the Kohanim. They get no chilek in the Biza. Why then, in the case of Melchemes Midjan, did the Torah go out of its way to command explicitly that part of the Biza be divvied up amongst Shevet Levi? I think the answer lies in Aluch Yud Aleph. The Rambam says, Yirali, Shein Advarim Amurim Ela Ba'aretz. It only applies to Eretz Yisrael within the bounds. All other lands we can give a biza to the Kohanim and to the Levim. This Isur doesn't apply. So basically, where we have a din of Nachla, of divvying up the land in Eretz Yisrael, there the Melchama takes on a new status, the goal of which is to conquer Eretz Yisrael and divvy it up, and the Kohen and the Levim are not part of that whole process of Kibush and Yerusha of Eretz Yisrael. When it comes to other wars, battles against the nations, and we conquer them, and we take their biza, in such a case, the halacha of Nachla, of Yerusha, of Yeshiva, of conquering Eretz Yisrael and divvying it up doesn't apply, and therefore the biza can be shared by the Levium and the Kohen. Okay. Last but not least, in the halachic part of that discussion, I mentioned that there's a question about the status of snow, and now we're going back to the parsha of those two psukim of the kalim that were taken from the Midjanim. And the Torah says those kalim have to be subject to the Torah, to a process of Tara, so that we can use them. That Tara has to be in the same mikvah as a Nida is Tovelis bar. And the question is, can we put these kalim into snow? And that's a very interesting question. I'll tell you why. It may not seem so fascinating to you at first glance, but as it turns out, the issue of what is the status of Sheleg, of snow, is actually almost an explicit contradiction between one sugya and another sugya, or at least one sugya and a tosefta of Raisa. Because the Gemara in Nida on Daf Yud Zayin quotes the Tosefta, and the Mishnah at the end of the 7th Perek of Mikvos seems to say the exact opposite. And that is the following. We'll start with the Mishnah at the end of the 7th Perek of Mikvos, and it says, Elu Malin Es HaMikvah. The following substances can be added to a mikvah that doesn't have 40 saw to make up the difference. Hasheleg v'abarat. And then the Mishnah goes on to tell us that Rabbi Yishmael wanted to argue with this halacha that was formulated by Rabbi Akiva to say that sheleg ain't omales hamikvah, but heidu anshe midbar. There was a place where they testified that Rabbi Yishmael told them tzu ve'viu sheleg v'asu mikvah mitchila. So apparently Rabbi Yishmael changed his mind and eventually embraced the sheet of Rabbi Akiva, and Sheleg has the same status as Mayim, and you can be Tovil and Sheleg. However, the Gemara Nida on Daf Yud Zayin quotes a Braisa. And the Braisa says the following: Sheleg, ain't a lo ochel velo mashke. You know, in Tuma, in Kabbalah's Tuma, we have two major categories. We have Ochlim with their dinim and Mashkim, liquids with their dinim. Sheleg is neither here nor there. What does it depend upon? Chishev olav lachila. If his mindset was to take the sheleg, melt it down, and use it, that's one thing. If his mindset was to make it into a mashke, it's a mashke. But then we have another part of the Tosefta, which is crucial for us. It says, nitma miktsaso lo nitma kula. Let's say that a sheretz, which is metame, falls into the snow. Does that sheretz have the power to be metame the entire snow, let's say snowman, you know, or flow of snow? And it says no. Rashi says why? The eno chibur. We don't view all the snow as one indivisible entity. El kol koret bifnei atzmo. Each snowflake is considered a separate entity. And therefore, v'eino tomei el mako maga hatuma. The tuma is limited to that particular place where the tuma had contact with the shelik. So the one who explains this halacha very beautifully lived in Vilna at the time of the Second World War. His name is Rav Henoch Egish. He was the great Dayan and the genius of Vilna. He wrote a sefer called Nar Cheshes. He was killed by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. Today we have our own enemies that are killing us. And basically Rav Henoch says the following in the Mar Cheshes. He says that from the Sugya Nida, according to Tosefta, we see that Sheleg ain't no chibur. We never view the Sheleg as one connected object. It's considered separate entities. And therefore he says the following. As far as nitma miktsaso, lo nitma kulo, we don't view it as if the entire shelig became tame. It's not connected. Therefore, he says, as far as mikvah is concerned, shelig should have the same identical status as keepin, which is a different sugya mikvos, reflects on the case of waves in the sea. And let's say the tameh went into the top of the wave, and the question is that is considered tefillah in the entire water. And do we view the wave as if it had our arbayim saw, even though in that particular part of the wave there is no concentration of our arbayim saw? So basically, since the halacha is ein matbilin bekeepin, he says the same halacha should apply with regard to creating a mikvah 40 saw in the case of shelek. In Mayim, he says, kol tipa v'tipa mechuberes zu l'zu, and therefore when you go into a mikvah, it doesn't matter whether your body comes in contact with 40 saw. Halachically, al pidin, it's as if your body dipped into 40 saw, because the entire 40 saw is called a chibur. But he says, al v'shelek she'enu mechubar, the kol koret nechshav kidavar nifra v'nei atzmo, harei lo tovah la'odam b'chol arboim saw. And the one who wrote an entire essay on the status of Sheleg is Rav Zevin, Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, in his book called The Ar Halacha. And basically he summarizes the sugya as a machlokes between the Mechaber and the Ramah. Because in Yoredeya and Siman Reish Aleph, the Mechaber says, Ein she'iva poselis bahen, in the case of Sheleg, if you add the Sheleg into the mikvah, it does not have the halacha of Mayim she'uva, which passes a mikvah. The afilu osas kol ha-mikvah mi-Sheleg, says the Mechaber. It's a kosher mikvah. The Ramah says no. The Ramah says, Yesh machmirim Shalolitbo b'chol eile, in this whole list of cases, we don't use it as a mikveh. Ela v'nimochu v'nasu mayim. We have to wait until the snow melts and becomes water, and then it's natural water. It has the same status as water from mikveh. So the question is, are the flakes mechubar or not mechubar? This seems to be a stira, a conflict between two sugyas. One sugya assumes that you can use mayim, that's a mishnah at the end of the seventh parak of mikvos, you can use shelig, excuse me, to be mashlim and mikvah, which must mean that it's mechubar to the water of the mikvah, and yet the tosefta quoted by the sugya nida seems to assume the opposite, and Rashi embellishes that, that there's no chibur in the case of Shelek. In any event, there are a lot of tshuvas on this. The Shach was absolutely machmir. He would not allow a woman to be tovelis in Shelek, even b'shas hadchak. He was makil only in the case of netilas yadayim. I'm not sure what bracha you would make, but he would allow you to put your hands into the Shelek and then eat bread. Because netilas yadayim is only derabbanan. But when it comes to mikveh d'oraisa, and we have to be very, very careful about the mikveh, and the laws of the mikveh, we were machmir, and we're not going to allow tefillah in shelek. However, there's a tshuva that some so fair, that maybe we can be a little bit, it's very complicated. It would seem that la'alacha, shelek, does not qualify as a mikveh until it melts and becomes part of the mikveh, part of the water. I was just thinking out loud, what would be the status of Sheleg as far as Tefillas Kalim is concerned? Can we be more Makil in Tefillas Kalim than in the case of Anida? And this Lechora might depend upon what the status of Vitoyer is. Most Rishonim assume that Vitoyer here in Parshas Matos is a mitzvah d'oraisa, and if you would use the kli that was manufactured or purchased from a guy without tefillah, then you'll be mevatel a mitzvah d'oraisa, and therefore in the case of Suffolk, we want to be machmir. Other Rishonim say that it's not a d'oraisa, and the whole question is how do they interpret the pasuk of v'toyer, b'mei nida yischata, what they use it for. Maybe in that context, we can apply the Shach's rule that he applies to netilas yadayim. Okay, this is part one of the Shia, this is the halachic part. And now I want to talk a little bit of hashkafa. First of all, in terms of the concept of mikvah, and why a kli of all things, a utensil, pots and dishes, should require tefillah in a mikvah, I want to share with you the insights, you may have read it already, but it's always kedai to go over it, of the great Rav Aryeh Kaplan, Zichrono Livracha. Here's the book, it's called The Aryeh Kaplan Anthology Part 2. And on pages 334 and 335, he addresses the case of our parasha, Parshas Matos, eating utensils, cooking utensils. If they're made out of metal or glass, they require tefillah. Oh, by the way, tefillah in the case of glass is clearly, according to everyone, only derabbanan, and therefore, if you have no access to a mikveh, I would suggest relying on the shach, and you can be tovel your glassware in Shelek. In any event, why utensils? And basically, if I could summarize the Ikar Yisod, the fundamental breakthrough here for Vary Kaplan, he goes back to the case of a ger. A non-Jew comes to convert and needs tefillah in a mikvah, male or female, there's no difference. And in the case of Kalim, we need a kind of a gerus, a quasi-conversion, in order to allow these utensils that come from a non-Jewish source, non-Jewish creation or possession, and now are being placed on a Jewish table, which of course the Shulchan is like the Mizbeach, we need a process of tahara, but that tahara really is meant to change the status of the kli. And he says the following, we find mikvah in two different contexts. One is to remove tumah. However, in this case of kalim, we're not talking about a kli that's tameh. It might be tameh if a sheretz fell into it, but maybe not. But we're talking about an entirely different concept of mikvah. And that concept, he says, applies in the following cases. Number one, in the case of Aaron, in the chinuch process in which he was inducted to become the Kohen Gadol, Aaron Ubanov, they had to be subject to tefillah b'mikvah. Number two, the Kohen Gadol on Yom HaKippurim needs 10 tefillos in mikvah, obviously not for the sake of tumah, but rather to allow him to enter into the Kodesh Kedoshim. Number three, we find in the case of a ger. Number four, we find it in the case of tefillos kelim. Says Rav Kaplan, the underlying common denominator to all these cases is a change of status. A change of status requires a radical change in the personality of an individual, of a human being, and even in the case of pots and dishes. Why is it that in all these cases that we mention, when there's no tara from tumah, do we talk about dipping into the mikvah as a process of change of status? Aaron is now accepting upon himself kohuna gedola. The Kohen Gadol is now entering into Lifnai V'Lifnim. He has to undergo a radical change. The most dramatic example of this is the ger. Chazal say about a ger is kikaton shenolad dami. He's brand new birth. And in the case of kelim, we have to change the status of the kelim to give it the status of a kli Yehudi, of a Jewish kelim, so to speak, that can be placed on our mizbeach, on our shulchan. So if the concept of change of status underlies all these cases of mikvah, of tefillah, why mikvah? Why is it that of all ritual acts that symbolize and engender a change of status, mikvah was chosen by the Torah? Of course, we can never know the answer to that question. It's a gzeiras hakosav. And no matter what human rational explanation we're going to give, it can never exhaust the topic. It's divine. But the rational mind tries to reach out to whatever possible explanation we can come up with. And here's his thesis, which you all may be familiar with. There was a radical change in the nature of man as a result of the Chet HaKadmon of Adam HaRishon. Adam HaRishon, Kodem LaChet, was meant to live for all immortality. Death was a result of the Chet. Adam HaRishon was not subject to Tumah V'Tara. Adam HaRishon lived in Gan Eden. Gan Eden was a place where there was Gilui Shechina, where there was the voice of Hashem. But after the Chet, a whole change in the nature of man took place. Before the Chet, there was no Yetzirah within man. The Yetzirah was external to man. It only became internal as a result of the Chet. The Nachash HaKadmoni was external to man, presented two possibilities. Man was meant to use his rational mind and make the right decision. There was freedom of choice, but of a different sort entirely. Now, as a result of Chet, the Yetzirah penetrates into our very being. We live a life of confusion, of ambiguity, constantly facing moral decisions and choosing between right and wrong. As a result, the entire world was changed. The nature of the universe was absolutely fundamentally different. However, there was one place in the world that God asked us to create that would be free of all the influences of tumah and yetzahara of evil, that would be dedicated totally to Gilui Shechina, and would be similar to Adam HaRishon's Gan Eden Kodem LaChet. That's the sanctuary. V'asuli migdash v'shachati b'socham. Nothing, no even shemetz of tumah is allowed anywhere near the Beis HaMikdash. Says Rav Kaplan, based on very early Kabbalistic sources, that if you look at the parsha of Adam HaRishon, all of a sudden, in the middle of the parsha, if we have a chance, I'll read it inside, the Torah describes how there was a river that came out of Gan Eden, and there were four tributaries to the river. That river, which seems to be totally out of place in the context of the episode of Adam HaRishon Kodem LaChet, represents Gan Eden. It's the only thing that's left today of Gan Eden. Those waters are the waters of the mikvah. The waters of the mikvah allow a person to enter into Gan Eden even post Chet Adam HaRishon. And by subjecting ourselves to the waters of Gan Eden, we recreate ourselves We go back to being, to some extent, Adam HaRishon Kodem L'Chet, that Bria, that idyllic man that was from Misofo Olaviad Sofo, that was meant to live forever. It's a rebirth of sorts. And whenever we need a fundamental change of status, we enter into the mikvah. We take these kelim here in Parshas Milchamis Midjan, and we subject them to tefillah in a mikvah. Okay, I'll take a break now for a minute to answer questions. Number one, there's a question here from Daniel, and Daniel is asking me, by way of chat, if the temperature would change, in other words, what would be the status of a mikvah that froze? If you're going into the ice of the mikvah, there's no longer a chibur, and it has the same status as snow. If you're breaking the ice and you're going into the water below the ice, which was classically done by Nashim Tzidkaniyos by our ancestors 100 years ago, that itself is a mikvah water, but not the ice itself. I have a question here from David. David is asking the following question. In one case, the snow can be considered connected to make a mikvah, not in the case of the sheretz for tumah. Again, what we're suggesting is that there is a certain consistency. Both in the case of tumah, we have no chibur, there's no connection, and in the case of mikvah, we have no connection. Meaning that when there is no chibur, the tumah is isolated and concentrated in one place where there was maga, where there was contact, and we don't have mikvah because you can never actually say that you were tovel in the 40 saw because each part was separate from each other. I hope I was clear. Now there's a question from Daniel regarding the classification of Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, which governs the halachas of Yerusha, of Nachla, of Biza. Is there a machloket regarding Kedushas Eretz Yisrael in Evra Yarden? And the answer is that Evra Yarden is also a halach of Kibush Eretz Yisrael. It may be lacking in certain elements of Kedushas Eretz Yisrael as far as Trumas and Maestros are concerned. But nevertheless, as far as the laws of Milchama, as far as the mitzvah of Kibush, as far as the Nachla, to divvy up that land, Evra Yarden, to 2.5 Shvatim, yes, everybody agrees that Eretz Yisrael is, that Evra Yarden is an essential part of Eretz Yisrael. My Rebbe Rav Salvech used to call it Shem Eretz Yisrael, not Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, but Shem Eretz Yisrael in the case of the Milchamis Mitzvah of Kibush is enough to engender Nachla and all the Isurim that apply with regard to Shevet Kahuna, Shevet Leviyah to take from the Biza. Chaim is asking that we mispalel together for the forces of the IDF, of Tzahal, and for all of Am Yisrael. We are in a major milchama here, Milchemes Midjan, all over again, Nikom Nikmas Bnei Yisrael. Okay, I see, David, you have another question with regard to the Sheretz. I'm going to leave that for later because we don't have much time. I want to add another few minutes and tell you a story that I found here in the Sefer on Parshas Matos. After the Six-Day War, when Eretz Yisrael and its bounds were expanded, we were on the Shari Damesek, we returned to the Kotel, to Kever Rachel, to Maros Samach Pela. All of a sudden, a very small country became a much larger country until, unfortunately, what happened in Milchemes Yom HaKippurim. But there was a Rav Edelstein who was alive at the time of the Six-Day War, and shortly afterwards he invited his community in a neighborhood called Ramat HaSharon, which is very famous for the Anshei Tzava Keva that live in that area, and he asked a Rav Yaakov Galinsky, who's also no longer alive, to come and speak at that occasion. It was a kind of celebration following the euphoria of the military success and campaign of the Six-Day War. However, Rav Galinsky, when he got there, and he arrived from Yerushalayim, from Bnei Brak, excuse me, Rav Edelstein notified him, Lo nahug sherabanim nosim kan drashot. You're part of this mamad, but you're not allowed to give a whole drasha. So Rav Galinsky asked him, so why did I come? He said, look, we can have a symposium tonight with questions and answers. So Rav Galinsky says, you mean I'll be attacked the entire evening? What he meant was that I'll be attacked because Bnei Brak Charedim don't serve in the army? Is that what's going to happen? So you know what? He goes up to the Bama, to the Bima, and he says, you know what? You don't want to hear a drasha, but are you willing to hear a story? That they said we could hear. He tells a story about the city of Posen, which was the city of Rabbi Akiva Eger. And the Haskalah movement was expanding like by wildfire, like wildfire in Posen. And many Jews who were Bali Amuna were swept away by the Haskalah movement. Amongst those progressive Jews, if you call them that, was one Baal Tokea. He was a well-known Baal Tokea. And when the word got around that his emuna was questionable because he was taken by the maskilim, so the Rav of the city of Posen at that time decided that this individual could no longer serve as he had served most of his life as the Baal Tokea in Posen. As a result, this individual came in front of the Moshe La'ir, the Paritz, to complain and to be malshin against the Rav of the city. And he said to the Moshe La'ir, I admire progress. I'm one of those progressive Jews. And as a result, the Rav takes away from me, robs me of my ability to blow the shofar. So the Moshe agreed that this was a terrible thing that was done to him, a crime that was perpetuated, and he immediately called the Rav Ha'ir to show up, and he asked him what's going on over here. So the Rav answered the following. There's some misunderstanding here. This man is an ingrate. He says, not only have I not rejected him, on the contrary, I elevate him to a higher level. So the Moshe says, can you explain yourself? So he says to the Moshe, who's a non-Jew, obviously, he says to him, do you know what's the holiest day in the Jewish calendar year? He says, of course I know that. That much I know about Judaism. It's Yom HaKippurim. He says, you know what? Yom HaKippurim is an entire 24-hour period which reaches its pinnacle with the blowing of the shofar at the end of the fast. This man that is sitting now and complaining, what an ingrate. We decided to upgrade him and he will blow the shofar of Yom HaKippurim at the apex, at the pinnacle of the day. Immediately, the Moshe was misfiled. He was very, very impressed. And he began asking 1,000 slichos from the Rav, and he turns to this Jew, he says to him, why didn't you tell me that the Rav appointed you to blow the shofar at the apex of the tefillah on the holiest day of the year, you're fasting? The Jew didn't know whether to laugh or cry. He says, should I try to explain to him that Rosh Hashanah is a mitzvah d'oraisa and the blowing of the shofar at the end of Yom Kippur is nothing more than a minhag? I don't think this guy will understand that. So instead he blurts out, he says, on Rosh Hashanah we blow 100 kolos. At the end of Yom Kippur we only blow one kol. One set of kolos. So the Moshe looks at him. Are you an idiot? The shofar is in your hand? And you're blowing one? Keep blowing once the shofar is in your hand. Anyway, Rav Galinsky used this cute story to try to explain that once he's up here on the Bima, he's going to talk. And basically, he refers to Melchemes Midjan in our parsha. And he says that according to the Midrash Rabbah, Moshe Rabbeinu set up 1,000 soldiers, mind you, to stay behind and be mispalel and dedicate themselves to tefillah. Could he have taken the old gizzards who had passed retirement age? He had to take chayalim, and no less than 1,000 chayalim for each shevet, 12,000 chayalim mispalelim. Why? And the answer is that Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to be mashrish. He wanted to instill within our hearts and our minds the acknowledgement that tefillah is a necessary part of milchama. That there are two parts to milchamos. And those who have the schus of tefillah are not less important. And they number exactly the same as the lochamim before. And therefore, I think when we apply this logic to our situation, that's what Rav Galinsky said, b'shaito, and we ask ourselves, as I hear on the radio all the time, what do we in the Oref, here in the civilian sector, what is our responsibility? And obviously we have to deal with issues of bitachon, of faith, and support. We have to do whatever we can. And if the azakah goes off, as it did last Shabbos in the middle of my shia, we have to all get over to the miklat, not the ear miklat, but the miklat. But in addition to that, our obligation is one of tefillah. And I believe that this applies not just to the Jews here in the Oref and Eretz Yisrael, it applies to Jews all over the world. Ask me what you can do. Okay, maybe there are financial things you can do. Maybe you could even come here for support. I don't know. But one thing we need, and that's clear, and that's tefillah. We need prayer. And that's something that we all have to gather together, as we did when we lost the three boys earlier in this case, because we're losing them now in Gaza, and we need all your tefillos. It's interesting that the Gemara tells us that in the case of Shechem, when it says, Vayikhu Shimon Velevi Ish Charbo, Vayavo al Ir Betach, Vayargu Kol Zochar, you remember that Shimon Velevi took the Cherev and they destroyed the city of Shechem, not a very pro-Jewish city. And then it says, Vayavo al Ir Betach. Says Rashi, what's Betach? Bituchim Hoyu al Kocho Shal Yaakov Avinu. They relied on the schus of Yaakov Avinu. And that schus of Yaakov Avinu was transmitted to Yosef. At the brachos in Parshas Vayechi, Yaakov says to Yosef, Nasati lecha, ani nasati lecha, Shechem echad al achecha, a reference to Shechem, asher lakachti miyad hamori becharbi ubekashti, says Rashi, what's becharbi ubekashti, betoroso ubetfiloso, with Yaakov Avinu's dedication to the study of Torah and his dedication to tefillah. And we find this also with regard to the Yerushalmi in the case of Bar Koziva, who, as you know, Rabbi Akiva thought was the Mashiach. And the Gemara tells us in Yerushalmi and Tainis in the fourth parak, calls Manchai Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Lazar Modaim Ispalel, Nachal Bar Koziva Nitzchonos. As long as Rabbi Lazar HaModa'i was alive and he was mispalel, Bar Koziva was successful in battle. Kisha Mace, the moment he died, Nilkada Beitar, Beitar was taken, it fell to the enemy, Venerag Bar Koziva. It's unbelievable. And this is something that repeats itself throughout Chazal. Yiratzon, may it be his will, that through our tefillos and through the Mesiris Nefesh of our Chayalim on the front, there should be a Shituf Pula. We should be two parts of one whole. And we should be Zocher to see the end of any tragedy and the protection of Klal Yisrael here in Eretz Yisrael. Kein Yiratzon. Amen. If there are any questions, you can turn on your mics now, or I can read some of the chat here. I see there's a question here from, let me just see who's asking the question. Oh, Daniel Mayer says, that his 8-year-old son asked if the Chayalim have to fast on Tisha B'Av. That's an interesting question. I would say absolutely not. They should not fast on Tisha B'Av. That's my opinion. You could ask your local Orthodox rabbi. Then there's a question from David with regard to a sheretz. With regard to a sheretz, can it be metami snow? And the answer is, only where there was contact with the snow. Oh, you're asking according to the Mechaber, I hear your question. The Mechaber seems to opt in favor of one of the two sources that we discussed, and that's the Mishnah in Masechta Mikvos. We never were able to square and reconcile that Mishnah with the law of Tumah V'Tahara in the Tosefta, which is quoted in Masechta Nida. You're asking basically the following. According to the Mechaber, who accepts the fact that you could be mashlim a mikvah with sheleg, what would be the status as far as chibur is concerned? Are we assuming that sheleg has a chibur according to the Mechaber as reflected in the Mishnah in Mikvos? I don't know. There are two possibilities here. Either he sees that as a chibur, or he would require lechatchila a tefillah in the snow only if you can compact the snow, if you can squash it together like a snowman, you know, that we do, and make it into our bottom saw. But again, if it's so compact, I don't know if there's any way of being metar yourself in such snow, but it could be nogea as far as Tumas Sheretz is concerned, that now you've made that chibur. So again, I don't know. Is natural snow in its natural form a chibur according to the Mechaber, or do we have to do some sort of malachuti action to be mechaber, to compact all the snow together and make it into a chibur, and the nafkamina would be legabi Tumas V'Tahara. Okay, Rabosa, I have to go. I would just ask you to be emissaries, to get other people to join our learning. I think especially at this time, if you have any way of publicizing it amongst your email list. Again, I'm not asking for anyone to sign a contract, just to give it a try, give it a test trial. And we're basically focusing on three time periods. Thursday night at 10:30 p.m. on the Eastern Seaboard clock, because that seems to be a popular time. And we had our first trial on, I call it Friday, because on my clock it was Friday morning. If we can get any Australians on the group, that would be a lunch and learn in Australia. It would be 12:15 p.m. on the Australian clock, 12:30 p.m. on the Australian clock. It's 5:30 a.m. on the Israeli clock, and it's 10:30 p.m. on the Eastern Seaboard clock. We can also offer shiurim, as I'd like to do tomorrow, at 12:15 p.m., possibly 8:15 p.m. as well. Each year we'll be on a different topic, Amir Tzashem, but I just have to know if we have enough of a critical mass to send out an invitation. Every shiur requires that I invite every single individual through WebEx. Otherwise, if you don't get invited, I don't know that you have a way of linking into the shiur. Once you get invited, it's a pretty simple process. You press join, they may ask you for your email address, but that's about it. Okay, Rabos, I have to run. It's 8:15 p.m. here, and I haven't seen my family since the wee hours of the morning. So I'll wish everyone a great deal of hatzlacha. It was great seeing you. I saw Daniel Mayer for the first time with his camera working. I saw David Isover for the first time. Others here have not put on their cameras. Maybe they don't have cameras, but it was a great experience for me. Again, Parshas Matos is endless like any parsha, but I tried to give us a little bit of halacha, a little bit of lumbus, and a little bit of hashkafa as well, especially regarding to the mikvah. We should be zochet to see Yeshuos v'nitzachon with God's protection through our tefillos, through the work and the dangerous work of the chayalim. Kein yiratzon. Amen. Thank you very, very much.